and a pro-West and anti-China. They're saying that China is just entering into this agreement for the sake of China, and it's not going to help others.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. We don't have much more to add to that. Thank you for that, Atif Abayadar, researcher and journalist. Okay, in our final report, we're going to take a look at how the RCEP compares to other great trade deal giants, in particular, focusing on the EU and the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. So stay tuned.
It seems that the world has phased in and out of trade agreements from the moment the concept was invented. The likes of NAFTA was quashed by Donald Trump, which resulted in the birth of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada deal, and the EEC was reborn into the EU in Europe, showing that flexibility and change are important parts of trade deals as they adapt to varying circumstances around the world. With the RCEP, it seems that the agreement, whilst on paper sounds very promising, could show signs of weaknesses like other pacts that have been and gone before them. Could then other trade agreements around the world emulate the examples set by the RCEP? And if so, just how?
I think in terms of the general direction of this agreement is something that this is something that the other parts of the world can probably learn from. But in terms of the actual impact, I think it still needs to be rigorously assessed to see how it actually bring positive impact to these member countries.
So why then do trade agreements collapse? In theory, the signing of a deal which can boost an economy should be a win-win situation for all parties concerned. Yet when we look back at trade agreements of the past, and even the ones that are still in play, one of the major challenges to maintaining an agreement is the political differences between nations. Take for example the case of the EU. The varying cultures and political views in Europe is as wide as the spectrum can allow, and is hence why the UK, for example, broke away from the EU. Yet as we all know, and have seen, the devastating economic cost of Britain appears to be far greater than the benefits of leaving the bloc over political differences. The same can be said of the NAFTA agreement, which saw Trump pull out of, citing a bad deal. This is another example of how differences in political thought have changed the shape of trade deals that were actually quite successful in the first place. For the RCEP, only time will tell whether it stands the test of time and political opinion. But from an optimistic point of view, the notion of multilateralism is a concept that should be embraced. And if the world starts to see super trade deals emerging, for example, between the EU and the RCEP, then the future may look very bright for the global economy and trade.
As the world emerges from one of the most devastating impacts to human life, as well as the economy, so too does it seem that the world is looking forward to a new political agenda. As the notion of multilateralism appears to be a common denominator, as countries bind together to create pockets of economic powerhouses around the world. With the EU, US, MIX, CAN, and now the RCEP all being fine examples of how economies can work together towards a mutually beneficial system, the winds of change are starting to blow as the likes of China, South Korea, and Japan work their way up the economic ladder, threatening the position of the US and showing that the self-centered approach led by Donald Trump is a dated and ineffective way of building an economy. What now remains to be seen is whether the creation of the RCEP as a global competitor to the likes of the EU may spark in the future a super trade deal pact, merging together the likes of the RCEP and the EU, creating a multilateral pact never seen before. Well, a lot remains to be done, but the future may just hold such a story. That's about all the time we have for this episode. On behalf of myself, Trevor Tafway, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe, and we'll see you again next time.
The Limelight.
Promoting natural herd immunity, which Trump and others in his administration have consistently done, would undoubtedly lead to more individuals having to live with serious long-term health issues. Since the start of the pandemic, more than 15.2 million Americans have contracted the coronavirus. And, as of now, 286,443 individuals have died from COVID-19. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Trump backs herd immunity and calls millions contracting COVID. Terrific. Here's the details of this article. During a White House coronavirus vaccine event that took place on Tuesday, December 8, Donald Trump appeared to voice strong support for the idea of so-called natural herd immunity, the controversial idea that the population can develop immunities and stop the spread of a virus simply by allowing it to run its course without significant efforts to mitigate it. Throughout the year, Trump has been reluctant to back social distancing standards, including encouraging individuals to restrict personal travel and to wear masks, which have been found effective in actually limiting the spread of COVID-19. He has also dangerously downplayed the seriousness of coronavirus in spite of describing the pandemic as deadly earlier this year in an interview with Bob Woodward. On Tuesday, December 8, Trump described vaccines for COVID-19 as goal that was number one because that's the way it ends, referring to the pandemic. But in other comments, he suggested that large numbers of infections in the U.S. over the past year were somehow a good thing. I hear we're close to 15%. I'm hearing that, and that's terrific. That's a very powerful vaccine itself, Trump said, describing the number of Americans estimated to have had coronavirus so far. In fact, a recent study from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, notes that closer to 16% of Americans have likely had the virus, many without presenting symptoms. But that means a significant number haven't yet been exposed to COVID-19. This indicates that approximately 84% of the U.S. population has not yet been infected, and thus most of the country remains at risk despite already high rates of hospitalization, a report from the health agency said. Over the past several months, White House officials have demonstrated an eagerness to accept the idea of herd immunity, even going so far as to peddle a petition that signaled support for the concept from supposed medical professionals. While the petition did include real doctors and health professionals who believed in promoting the herd immunity, many of the names on the list turned out to be pranks based on common jokes such as Dr. I.P. Freely and Dr. Person fake name. That dubious petition, endorsed by officials within the Trump administration, suggested that a herd immunity threshold of 20% was all that was needed in order to reduce the impact of the spread of COVID-19. However, most epidemiologists disagree with that idea, as immunity for other infectious diseases typically requires over 90% of the population to be vaccinated to prevent the spread of that disease. For example, a disease requires a 94% vaccination threshold to achieve herd immunity. So-called natural herd immunity, developing immunities within a population without using safely administered inoculations, has been denounced by most health experts as a dangerous method of trying to combat coronavirus. Many have likened it to the practice of eugenics, as it would probably result in millions of deaths among individuals with weaker immune systems. Beyond the mortality rate for COVID, there are grave concerns about its long-term effects among survivors, many of whom are now living with debilitating symptoms. It's also unclear how long these symptoms, which can include blood clots and organ failure, will linger. Promoting natural herd immunity, which Trump and others in his administration have consistently done, would undoubtedly lead to more individuals having to live with these serious long-term health issues. Since the start of the pandemic, more than 15.2 million Americans have contracted coronavirus, and as of now, 286,443 individuals have died from COVID-19.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان العين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salaamu alaykum, dear brothers and sisters. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. And welcome to the program of Islamic Upbringing here on IRIB English Radio. In this program, we discuss the problems and questions the parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmi Aqum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Miqdad.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad, one of our listeners, they're having a question. Let me read it out for you. It says that I'm going to be a mentor at an Islamic camp for 10-year-olds. Could you give me some tips on how to have positive effects on these Muslim children? What do you have to say about it, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There's a lot to be said regarding mentors and perhaps requires a much more detailed discussion. But just a couple of points that come to mind right now. The role of mentors for children is extremely, extremely influential. Uh-huh. Little children, especially children that are at the age of 9, 10, 11, they really look up to their mentors, mm-hmm. People that they spend time with, especially in places like Islamic camps. And this is just a reminder for our communities to make sure that they actually strengthen these courses, these camps that happen perhaps throughout the year or mostly in summer, mm-hmm. Where children get together and go to a place, a particular place, where whether it's a weekend or a week or 2 weeks, yeah. And they spend time with mentors and teachers, learning about different things at the same time, doing sports and mm-hmm. activities and away from the family, basically. Yeah. These are very, very impactful in the life of a young child. And the role of mentors in that is extremely, extremely powerful, and we need to be very careful. So first and foremost is really to pray to Allah and ask Allah's help for this, because any impact that you will have on this will actually be very impactful. It's not something that we can take lightly. Uh-huh. So inshallah, we pray to Allah. We go into this camp with a lot of sincerity, with a lot of dua, a lot of tawassul to the Ahlul Bayt, that Allah can help us basically to make sure that we have the right impact on these children. So inshallah, through sincerity, we can achieve a lot. The second point is to keep in mind that children will learn more from what they see than what they hear. Uh-huh. So the way we behave, not just in relation to children, but generally the way we mm-hmm. behave is often more impactful than what we teach them through our words. Mm-hmm. And so as a mentor, it's very important to always be careful of our actions. That yeah.
So
how you behave.
Children learn from their elders.
Exactly. They learn when they see. If you want to teach a child, for example, to pray on time, uh-huh. right? There's one way we can have a whole class about the importance of praying on time, mm-hmm. etc. But there's a better way, is to actually be there on time for namaz.
Yeah, that's right.
For you're playing football, having loads of fun, adhan's coming, you stop the game and say, mm-hmm. I'm going to pray, it's time for prayers. Children will follow because yeah. they have respect for you. And so this is very crucial, that we need to show in our actions that what we want to teach them. So basically preach by actions.
So basically actions create a lot of impact on children.
Definitely. Another point is to build a very strong relationship with your mentees. Mm-hmm. The more, the closer this relationship, the closer the impact, the stronger the impact will be. Now, this relationship is built through a lot of respect, a lot of discussion, friendly discussions, but also doing things with them. So whether it's playing sports with them, whether it's sitting down and having dinner and lunch with them, basically, as a mentor, you should be with them throughout the adventures that they go through. Even though sometimes if it means that something you've never done in your life, and you might even be weak at it. For example, remember we had mentors that have never played football in their lives, right? Uh-huh. But just for the sake of the camp, it's okay, put some shoes on and put some tracksuit bottoms on and play football, even mm-hmm. though you don't know how to kick a ball. And it's okay if you get laughed a little bit, It shows that you're part with the camp, basically.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad, and dear listeners, we'll be right back after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So welcome back, dear audience, and we're discussing about how to create a relationship with children. So Brother Miqdad, please continue.
So the more close our relationship, the more we become a role model for children, right? Uh-huh. Because children actually count you as amongst them, but at the same time, as successful, at the same time older, at the same time better than them. So they actually count you as a kind of a role model. And this is a very important place, because then they look at everything you do as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting, once a scholar was saying that between the Dhuhr namaz and the Asr namaz, he removed his watch whilst he was praying because he was sweating, it was really hot.
Uh-huh.
After the Asr Salah, he realized that everybody else has taken their watch out.
Yeah.
Because they were just copying, basically. They were looking exactly what the scholar is doing, and they were following exactly what he was doing. So this is how we become.
So actions do really matter.
Definitely. So we need to be careful, basically. So that requires us to be careful what we do. One important thing is to realize that when we become role models, always try to then be an intermediary for the real role models. Because mm-hmm. we've talked about many times that the real models are the Ahlul Bayt for us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you become a role model, your duty is to actually say, you know what, I'm a role model, but I'm just an intermediary for you to take the Ahlul Bayt as role models.
Uh-huh.
So if you like something in me, always attribute it back to the Ahlul Bayt,
yeah.
right? So what they realize that this person is my role model, is doing this. I like him a lot. He's doing this. But he's told me that this is what the Ahlul Bayt used to do.
Yeah.
And so actually, they actually fall in love with the Ahlul Bayt ultimately.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Another point to consider and to be careful of is when it comes to difficulties that will come in the course, whether it's through events that are, for example, there was a mistake done, or for example, there was a fight, or for example, you wanted children to pray on time, but they weren't praying on time, or correcting things. We need to be careful, because obviously the role of the mentor is to make sure the camp runs very
right.
smoothly and that there's no issues, and when there is issue, to try and solve them.
Yeah.
We should be very careful as mentors to ensure that we give reminders at the right time, and
mm-hmm.
we do something called taghaful at the right time as well.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the issues can be solved through ignoring, especially when times when children have realized their mistake. You know, for example, let's say they had a fight between themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there was a fight, maybe a bit of tears, things got broken, for example. At times, you can just ignore it, or very indirect reminder. Right?
Yeah.
Because they know themselves the mistake, right? To go and point out the finger, oh, you did this bad thing and you did that bad thing, you shouldn't have done this, what lesson do you learn from this? It's actually aggravating the situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was unnecessary to do that. We knew our mistake, just ignore it. And when you ignore it, what happens is that children actually, their self-respect remains, basically. They don't feel embarrassed, because once you point them out, say, you made this mistake, now they count themselves as, you know what, my role model that I had as a role model now counts me very less. He
uh-huh.
doesn't respect me anymore.
Yeah.
My self-image has been tampered. And this actually will hamper and make it more difficult for you to work with them. So many a times, it's important to do taghaful, to ignore it. And when we do give reminders, we should be careful when do we give reminders and what kind of reminders we give.
Thank you so much, Brother Maghdad, and dear audience, thank you so much for staying with us. Do not go anywhere, because we'll be right back after a short break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
So welcome back, dear audience, and we were discussing about how a person can be a good mentor for children. So Brother Maghdad, I would like you to continue.
Well, we give reminders, always stick to reminders that are related to wajib and haram. Don't go into things that are mustahab, for example, or makruh, for example. Stick to, I'm talking about Islamic reminders, right?
Yeah.
Stick to things that are wajib and haram, and be as less harsh as possible. Remember, tarbiyah or having impact on children is an internal impact, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want them to adopt a certain action only for the period of the course. Yeah. That's a pointless goal.
Yeah.
For example, you want to teach them to pray on time,
mm-hmm.
right? There's one way we can have loads of rewards for those who pray on time during the next week, for example. The mm-hmm. course is a one-week course. The person who prays on time throughout the 7 days will get this reward, and if you don't pray on time, you'll get this punishment.
Yeah.
Now, what this will do is it will only make them change for 7 days. After mm-hmm. that, when they go back home, they'll be the same.
Yeah.
Right? They won't change anything. What you want to do in these 7 days is to change them inside.
Mm-hmm.
That from within, they want to pray on time. That even when they go home, there's no reward, there's no punishment, they've still got this change within them that they want to pray on time. And so this happens through role modeling, this happens through teaching them the importance of things, this happens through making them enjoy it,
yeah.
Making them enjoy, for example, sitting together and discussing intellectual discussion, asking questions and discussing and debating, reading a book, for example, yeah. praying, make prayers very attractive, make recitation of the Adhan, for example, mm-hmm. very beautiful. Make the Quran sessions very interesting.
Yeah.
These things actually make an internal change within them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big difference between discipline, where you want the camp to run very smoothly, everybody has recited their Quran, everybody mm-hmm. has prayed on time, but this will not have any effect, because after the course, when the rewards and punishment are gone, the back to normal life, nothing has changed. You want to have an internal change. When they go back home, they actually will carry on doing the things that you want them to do. So very important to know how to give these changes, mm-hmm. know how to make Islamic principles or Islamic rituals very, very attractive, very, very pleasurable, very, very amazing, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The best mentors, for example, are those who are able to create an amazement towards the Quran. That you want this child to go back home and says, "One thing I learned from the course is how amazing this Quran is,"
uh-huh.
right? Or, for example, to teach them about the importance of Salah, and to make them enjoy Salah, or to make them enjoy Dua, for example. Or simply to teach them how beautiful Islam is in terms of its impact on both the physical aspect and on the spiritual aspect. I learned that Islam encourages to do sport and to be clean and to shower every day and to make sure we're presentable. At the same time, Islam teaches us to pray and to fast and to give charity. So be very careful how we present Islam. There's a lot to say. Last point, I know time is running short, is if there's a lot of mentors together, working together, it's very important that you're always on the same page, you don't contradict one another, that you're working very well in synchrony, and that the relationship that you're showing with one another, the respect that you're showing one another, is very crucial, because children look at that as well. They see your behavior with other mentors as well, and how you talk to them and what you say between each other. And this will have an impact on their own friend circle and how they behave between themselves as well.
So thank you so much, Brother Maghdad. In this program, we're talking about how we can be a good mentor for children. So dear listeners, this was your host, Hassan Ain, and thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. And until another program, God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. Oh.
way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and how about starting the day by pondering on the words of the Prophet of Islam regarding his divinely decreed vicegerent, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Nobody properly knows Allah except me and Ali. Nobody properly knows me except Allah and Ali. Nobody properly knows Ali except Allah and me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Trump on Saturday, December 5th, claimed a Democratic-led Senate will destroy the military through a lack of funding. But U.S. Congress last week passed a $740 billion Pentagon budget while Americans await economic relief, says Kenny Stancil, writer in an article published under the heading Money for War. U.S. arms sales soar, and bipartisan militarism thrives amid COVID-19 pandemic. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The United States sold more than $175 billion in military equipment to foreign governments in the fiscal year that ended September 30. Pentagon and State Department officials announced recently a 2.8% increase compared to 2019, when weapons exports totaled just over $170 billion. The latest figures on arms transfers were released one day before President Donald Trump said that military offense is the most important thing a president can do during his mean, daring speech at the Republican Party Saturday night, December 6th, on behalf of Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue of Georgia, who are facing Democratic candidates Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, respectively, in runoff elections next month that will determine which party controls the U.S. Senate. Although he spent most of the evening repeating claims of voter fraud in November election and asserting that Democrats will cheat again, Trump on Saturday, December 5th, still encouraged rallygoers to support the two GOP lawmakers at the polls on January 5th to avenge his loss in the rigged presidential contest. At stake in this election is control of the U.S. Senate. And that really means control of this country, the president said. The voters of Georgia will determine which party runs every committee, writes every piece of legislation, controls every single taxpayer dollar. Trump's rationale for backing Loeffler and Perdue came in the form of a warning. If the radical Democrats get power, they will ram through the most extreme left-wing agenda ever conceived, while at the same time destroying the U.S. military through a lack of funding. Whereas Trump portrayed congressional Democrats as eager to pursue draconian military cuts, journalist Sarah Lazar argued last week that the annual approval of the gargantuan U.S. military budget, which she called one of the most reliable rituals in Congress, is so ordinary and overwhelmingly bipartisan, is barely considered newsworthy. The U.S. has by far the biggest military budget on the planet, spending more than next 10 countries combined. Lazar continued, there is no indication that U.S. lawmakers plan to reverse this trend anytime soon. For six consecutive years, the military budget has either increased or stayed roughly the same, taking inflation into account. As the nation's All Priorities Project pointed out in June, the military budget in 2019 accounted for 53% of the federal discretionary budget, while millions of the country's working class households, battered by the COVID-19 pandemic and corresponding economic crisis, await a new relief package that ameliorates widespread hardship, Congress had no problem passing legislation to continue U.S. military violence, Lazar added. Lazar pointed out that the Senate version of the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, passed on July 23rd in a vote of 86-14, while the House version was approved on July 21st by a margin of 295-125. This NDAA was subsequently approved last week by both chambers of Congress. Lazar wrote that while it is entirely routine at this point, it's useful to highlight on the eve of yet another massive Pentagon handout how the budget for war could instead go toward life-preserving social goods. That we can find the money for war but not for coronavirus relief exposes the moral rut at the center of U.S. politics, a rut that must be dug out and expunged if we are to get through this crisis, she added.
today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, dear brothers and sisters, Salamun Alaikum, and so welcome to this program, today's special. Our topic is about the concept of wealth in Islam. We invite you to listen to today's special.
Ya Allah, Ya Rahman, حقق آمانينا وفقنا في كل آن فيما سعينا. Ya Allah, Ya Mannan, حقق آمانينا وفقنا في كل آن فيما سعينا.
Grateful today for difference and change, for all colors and shades, 'cause you made it this way. وهبتنا النبراس في حب كل الناس أغبط لنا إحساس أنت هادينا.
Today, Monday, is the 28th of Rabiul Thani, 1442 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 24th of the month of Azar, 1399 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 14th of December, 2020 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. As every work, every job, everything will start with the Holy Quran. We open today's special by recitation of Surah Al-Anfal, verses 2-3.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. إنما المؤمنون الذين إذا ذكر الله وجلت قلوبهم وإذا تليت عليهم آياته زادتهم إيمانا وعلى ربهم يتوكلون.
The believers are only those who, when Allah is mentioned, their hearts become fearful, and when His verses are recited to them, it increases them in faith, and upon their Lord they rely.
الذين يقيمون الصلاة ومما رزقناهم ينفقون.
The ones who establish prayer, and from what we have provided them, they spend.
لا إله إلا الله. لا إله.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The true believers are those who are in awe of Allah because of His glorification and veneration. That is when the speech is delivered upon Allah's justice, retribution, and power they dread, and when the speech is about His bounties, kindness, graces, and rewards, they feel peace in themselves. Moreover, whenever a believer remembers the divine bounties and forgiveness of Allah, he obtains a favorable opinion and he rests. But when he remembers his own sins, he becomes inconvenient and anxious.
Yourself, can't you see this wonder spread in front of you? The clouds floating by, the sky so clear and blue, planets in their orbits, the moon and the sun, such perfect harmony. Let's start questioning ourselves, isn't this proof enough for us?
Now spending wealth, the messenger of Allah, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny said, "We, prophets, were not sent to amass the wealth, but to spend it. Indeed, Allah created the earth and supplied it with ample provision for all human beings. In it we find grains, fruits, vegetables, trees, animals, seas, fish, metals like iron, gold, silver, platinum, copper, and etc. And of course, oil. Other materials lie in the depth of the earth to satisfy the needs of people, like diamonds and coal. If these provisions are distributed equally among mankind, no one on this earth will remain in poverty. The Prophet of Allah explains to the Muslims how to distribute property, provisions, and charity to all people. He says, "Surely Allah sent the prophets to spend wealth on the needy and to teach people the way of spending. Allah never sent prophets to amass wealth and forget the poor. The prophets forbade the rich from amassing wealth and saving it in banks and treasuries, while others are left to live in miserable poverty." Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wa bihi nasta'in. In this episode, we are going to talk about wealth in Islam. One cannot say whether wealth is good or bad. It depends on the application, I mean, to which wealth may be put. At the same time, we find that throughout history and in all human civilizations, there have been many tribes, many communities of people where some people or some tribes who had much power, they tried to acquire more wealth, either by attacking other people, other peoples or other tribes, or throughout being involved in commerce, I mean, buying and selling goods and so on. Nowadays, tribe life is very much not in common. I mean, tribal life isn't that much practiced in the world. We find that the same nature or the same attitude has remained among people, in the sense that we find that great companies or great powers in the world, they have much wealth, and they usually don't allow poor people to join them. And through being a closed wealthy circle of people or communities or companies, they try to add to the wealth, and in this way they become wealthy, wealthier and wealthier in contrast to other people, or poor people who may become much poorer than before.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are
guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone.
This part, entitled Essential Islamic Teachings on Wealth. It is never acceptable to earn a living by doing wrong. Muslims must earn their wealth in a lawful or halal way. It is not to be earned by selling or buying things that God forbids us, such as alcohol or pork, or by engaging in illegal activities. God advises them against this. He says in chapter 4, verse 24, O you who have believed, do not consume one another's wealth unjustly, but only in lawful business by mutual consent.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio.
May this moment last forever in your hearts, a day you'll always remember every part.
Today's a special.
This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life. Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time.
Tips part, to simplify our spending. Dear friend, make a personal financial plan a second grader could understand. When people hear a budget, they may think of cold accountants, expressionlessly, number crunching over a stack of papers. But your personal budget do not have to be this way. If you like computers, get a program that can help you do this. If not, get a notebook or a folder and start doing this. Make it simple. Picture yourself as a second grader and ask yourself how you would budget your money. Remember, the only math functions you really need for this are what you probably learned in grade 2. Addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division.
In psychology, it has a term. They have a term to describe this state of the human being. They call it the hedonic treadmill. Google it. They call the state the hedonic treadmill. It's like you're on a treadmill. Just to stay at one point, you have to walk. Just to stay at the same point. When you walk on a treadmill, you don't get any further. You walk just to stay at the same very point. Because if you don't walk, you're going to fall behind. This is how we human beings are with our happiness, with materialism. If you want to stay happy with materialistic things, it's an uphill battle. You have to always run and walk just to stay at the same level of happiness. Because once you buy that thing, the fun, the excitement will only last a few days. And then you'll go back to square one. Now you need to look for the next best thing, and the third, and the fourth, and the fifth. And it never ends, does it? Because our desires keep on evolving. Whatever we get, no matter how great it is, after a few days, it gets old. It gets normal. It gets boring. And now we want something better and newer and greater. So our desires keep on evolving and we keep on wanting more and more and more. And does it ever end? It never ends. All of this, my friends, was mentioned more than 1200 years ago by Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. In such a beautiful hadith, he describes this phenomenon that we see. You know, the hedonic treadmill, the fact that we will never get enough of this dunya. He mentioned this 1200 years ago. He said, مَثَلُ الدُّنْيَا كَمَاءِ الْبَحْرِ. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, in this hadith, he says that the dunya is like salt water. The dunya is like salt water. The more you drink, he says, كُلَّمَا شَرِبَ مِنْهُ الْعَطْشَانِ ازْدَادَ عَطْشًا. The more you drink, the thirstier you get.
Dear friends, thank you for being with us till this part and part of today's special. We were speaking about wealth in Islam. Inshallah, we continue on another episode of today's special. So don't forget us on IRIB English Radio, today's special. Have a nice time.
Sometimes I can't see where I'm supposed to go. Sometimes I speed up when I should take it slow. But through all my hard times, when I lose my way, you're concealing my mistakes, yeah. I know you're always by my side, never turning out your light. When I need you most, your stars will shine. When I'm out there in the darkest place, worn and tired, I can still see you illuminate all my skies. When it feels like I've fallen too far from you, they are guiding me through.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.